shockwave through the guests, and the party immediately fell silent. Gabriel had his hand inside his jacket, fingers wrapped around the butt of the Beretta. There were waiters here, waiters there, half a dozen of them at least.
"Gabriel, there he is!"
Jacqueline gasped. She pointed in the direction of a white-jacketed man turning out of a corridor and into the kitchen. Gabriel looked at Cannon.
"Where's Arafat?"
"In my study, using the telephone."
"Where's the study?"
"At the end of that hall."
Gabriel pushed his way past the guests and ran down the hallway. When he burst through the door, he found himself confronted by a bodyguard pointing a pistol directly at his chest. Arafat was seated calmly behind the desk.
"I'm afraid he's come and gone," Arafat said. "I'm still here, however. No thanks to you."
Gabriel turned and ran out of the room. Tariq walked quickly through the kitchen and out onto the service landing. He pushed two of the cases of champagne he found there against the door behind him. They were not heavy enough to stop anyone from getting out the door. They were merely heavy enough to slow him down. Then Tariq walked down to the next landing, removed his Makarov, and waited. Gabriel charged into the kitchen, Beretta drawn, as the back door was closing. He sprinted across the room and tried to open it. The knob turned, but the door itself wouldn't move, so he took a step back and drove his shoulder into the door. It opened a few inches. He pushed again, and this time the door gave way slowly. Gabriel stepped onto the landing. He saw Tariq on the next landing down, his feet apart, the Makarov in his outstretched hands. Gabriel saw the muzzle flashes in the dim light, felt the first bullet tearing into his chest. As he crumbled, he wondered if Tariq had planned it this way all along. Then he saw Jacqueline's face above him. Jacqueline's beautiful face. Then her face turned to water, and then he blacked out. As Gabriel slipped into unconsciousness, Jacqueline screamed, "Call an ambulance!" Then she stood and started running down the stairs. Above her, she heard one of the security officers scream, "Stop!" She ignored him. She could hear the pounding of Tariq's feet echoing up the stairwell toward her. She reached into her pocket and removed the gun she had taken from the apartment in Brooklyn. She thought, "I've already done this once today. I can do it again." She ran. The stairs seemed to go on forever. She tried to remember what floor the apartment had been on. 17, yes, that was it. She was sure of it. She passed a door that said 8th floor. She was in good shape, though. He was dying. She reached the bottom of the stairwell. There was a metal fire door, and it was slowly closing. Tariq was right in front of her. She ripped the door open. Tariq was about 25 feet ahead of her in a long corridor. He was clearly exhausted. His strides were short and uncoordinated. He turned and looked over his shoulder, and Jacqueline fired two shots in quick succession. The first appeared to sail harmlessly over his head, but the second struck him high in the left shoulder, knocking him from his feet. As he landed on the ground, his gun fell from his grasp and slid along the corridor. Jacqueline moved forward and fired again and again and again, until the gun contained no more bullets, and she was quite certain Tariq Al-Hirani was dead. Jerusalem, March. Gabriel awakened. He looked at the luminous face of his watch, closed his eyes. 5:15. He lay there trying to calculate how long he had slept, trying to remember when he had lifted himself from the couch and dragged himself into bed. How long after that had it taken to slip into unconsciousness? Had he really slept? His mind had been so alive with dreams it felt as though he hadn't. He lay very still, waiting to see if sleep would take him again, but it was no good. Then came the sounds, the cry of a muezzin drifting over the Hinnom Valley from Silwan, a church bell tolling in the Armenian quarter. The faithful had awakened. The faithless and the damaged had little choice but to join them. He probed his chest with his fingertips, testing for pain. Not as bad as yesterday. Each day was a little better. He rolled gingerly out of bed, walked into the kitchen, brewed coffee, toasted some bread. He was a prisoner, and like any prisoner, he took comfort in the ritual of routine. His cell was not a cell at all, but a pleasant safe flat overlooking Zion Gate. Cool tile floors, white throw rugs, white furniture. It reminded Gabriel of a hospital, which, in many respects, it was. He pulled on a sweater, a gray cotton pullover with a stretched neck, and carried his breakfast through the French doors to the small table on the balcony. What would he do this day, he asked himself. Would he stay in and read, or would he try walking again? Walking, he found, helped him to think. It helped him to sort through the wreckage of the case. Yesterday he had walked all the way up the slope of Mount Scopus. Perhaps today he would make it even farther. In the evening, Shamron summoned Gabriel to Tiberias for supper. They ate on the terrace beneath a pair of hissing gas heaters. Gabriel didn't want to be there, but he played the role of gracious guest, listened to the old man's stories, told a few of his own.
Lev gave me his resignation today. He said he can no longer serve in an organization of which the director of operations is kept in the dark about a major operation.
He has a point. Did you accept it?
I had no choice, Shamron smiled. Poor little Lev's position had become untenable. We had crushed the serpent. We had beheaded Tariq's organization and rounded up his foot soldiers. Yet Lev was completely out of the loop. I explained my reasons for running the operation the way I did. I told him the Prime Minister needed ironclad deniability, and, unfortunately, that required deceiving my own deputy. Lev wasn't mollified.
And the rest of your problem children?
They'll be gone soon.
Shamron set down his fork and looked up at Gabriel.
There'll be several vacancies in the executive suite at Kingsol Boulevard. Can I tempt you back? How does Chief of Operations sound?
Not interested. Besides, I was never much of a headquarters man.
I didn't think so, but I'd never forgive myself if I didn't try.
What about the Americans? Have you managed to get back into their good graces?
Slowly but surely. They seem to have accepted our version of the story, that we'd run an agent into Tariq's organization and that the agent had been exposed, that we had no choice but to take appropriate steps to safeguard the agent's life. They're still furious that we didn't bring them into the picture earlier.
That's quite understandable, considering the way it ended. What did you tell them?
I told them we had no idea Tariq was in New York until Jacqueline freed herself and alerted us.
And they believed this?
Even I believe it now.
My name ever come up?
From time to time, Adrian Carter would like another go at you.
Oh, God.
Don't worry, I'm not going to let him talk to you again.
Before Gabriel had been allowed to leave the United States, he was forced to endure 8 hours of questioning. CIA, FBI, New York City Police. Shamron had been at his side, like a good defense attorney at a deposition, objecting, stonewalling, impeding every step of the way. In the end, it disintegrated into a shouting match. A full account of the operation against Tariq, based on anonymous Western and Middle Eastern intelligence sources, appeared in the New York Times 2 days later. Gabriel's name made it into print. So did Jacqueline's.
It was Carter who gave the Times the story, I'm convinced of it, Shamron said.
He shrugged.
I suppose he had a right to be angry with me. I had lied to him.
Shamron pushed his plate away a few inches, rested his stubby elbows on the table, and covered his mouth with his fist.
At least our reputation as a bold action service has been restored. After all, We did take down Tariq in the middle of Manhattan and save Arafat's life.
No thanks to me.
What are you talking about?
Tariq nearly killed me, and he could have killed Arafat if he hadn't got cold feet at the last minute. Why did he let him live?
Arafat is being very tight-lipped about what transpired in that room. Obviously, he said something that made Tariq change his mind.
Any sign of Yusuf?
Shamron shook his head. We'll keep looking for him, of course, but I doubt we'll ever find him again. He's probably deep in the mountains of Afghanistan by now.
How's Benjamin Stone?
Relaxing in the Caribbean aboard his yacht.
Shamron abruptly changed course.
I stopped in on Jacqueline today.
How is she?
Why don't you ask her yourself? She wants to see you.
In the evening of the next day, he stood on the beach at Herzliya and watched Jacqueline lean against a balustrade 2 floors above him, her arms folded, her gaze fixed on the sea, wind pushing strands of hair across her face. She wore a loose-fitting white blouse and the sunglasses of a woman in hiding. Gabriel waited for her to notice him. Eventually she would, he knew. She had been trained by Ari Shamron, and no pupil of the great Shamron would ever fail to take notice of a man standing below her terrace. When she finally saw him, a smile flared, then faded. She lifted her hand, the reluctant wave of someone who had been burned by the secret fire. They drank icy white wine on her terrace and made small talk, avoiding for a time everything that mattered. And then finally she was unable to stop herself.
So why did you come here after all these weeks, Gabriel? You never do anything without a reason.
He wanted to hear it one more time, Tariq's version of the story. The way he had told it to her that night during the drive from the border to New York. He looked out to sea as she spoke, watching the wind tossing the sand about, the moonlight on the waves, but he was listening fiercely. When she was done, he still couldn't put the final pieces into place. It was like an unfinished painting or a series of musical notes with no resolution. She invited him to stay for dinner. He lied and said he had pressing matters in Jerusalem.
Ari tells me you want to leave. What are your plans?
I have a man named Vecellio waiting for me in England.
Are you sure it's safe to go back?
I'll be fine. What about you?
My story has been splashed across newspapers and television screens around the world. I'll never be able to return to my old life. I have no choice but to stay here.
I'm sorry I got you mixed up in this business, Jacqueline. I hope you can forgive me.
Forgive you?
No, Gabriel. Quite the opposite, actually. I thank you. I got exactly what I wanted. A second's hesitation.
Well,
almost everything.
She walked him down to the beach. He kissed her softly on the mouth, touched her hair. Then he turned and walked to his car. He paused once to look over his shoulder at her, but she had already gone. He was hungry, so instead of going straight to Jerusalem, he stopped in Tel Aviv for dinner. He parked in Balfour Street, walked to Shinkin, purchased a newspaper from a kiosk, sat down at a cafe table on the sidewalk, and ordered falafel and beer. The lead article in the newspaper riveted him. Benjamin Stone, the maverick publisher and entrepreneur, is missing and feared drowned off St. Martin in the Caribbean. Authorities believe Stone fell overboard from his luxury yacht sometime during the night. A piece of his conversation with Shamron played over in his head.
How's Benjamin Stone? Relaxing in the Caribbean aboard his yacht.
When the food arrived, Gabriel folded his newspaper and dropped it onto the extra chair. He looked up and spotted a man outside on the sidewalk, slender, good-looking, black curly hair, blonde Israeli girl on his arm. Gabriel laid down his fork, stared directly at him, throwing all discretion and tradecraft to the wind. There was no doubt about it. Yusuf al-Tafiki. Gabrielle left money on the table and, for 30 minutes, followed the couple along Scheinkin, then Allenby, then down to the promenade. No question about it. He knew the man's walk as well as he knew his face. But was he left-handed or right-handed? He was right-handed, of course. Gabrielle could not have watched this man so long without knowing he was right-handed. If he was trained by the office, then, he'd wear his gun on his left hip. Gabrielle increased his pace and drew his Beretta. He pressed the barrel of the gun against the man's lower back. Then, in one quick movement, reached beneath his jacket and snatched the gun from the holster on his hip. Yusuf started to swivel. Gabrielle shoved the gun into his back even harder. "Don't move again, or I'll leave a bullet in your spine. And keep walking." Gabrielle spoke Hebrew. Yusuf stood very still. "Tell your girlfriend to take a walk." Yusuf nodded to the girl. She walked quickly away. "Move," Gabrielle said. "Where?" "Down to the beach." They crossed the promenade, Yusuf leading, then descended a flight of steps to the sand. "Who are you?"
"Fuck you! Who do you think you are, grabbing me like that?"
"You're lucky I didn't kill you. For all I know, you're a member of Tariq's organization. You might have come to Israel to plant a bomb or shoot up a market. I still might kill you unless you tell me who you are."
"You have no right to talk to me like that."
"Who ran you? Who do you think?" "Shamron."
"Very good. Everyone always said you were smart."
"Why?" "You want to know why? You talk to Shamron. I just did what I was told. But let me tell you one thing. If you ever come near me again, I'll kill you. I don't care who you used to be."
He held out his hand, palm up. Gabrielle gave him the gun. He slipped it back into his holster. Then he turned and walked across the darkened beach toward the bright lights of the promenade. Lightning flickered over the hills of the Upper Galilee as Gabrielle drove along the shore of the lake toward Shamron's villa. Rami waited at the gate. When Gabrielle lowered the window, Rami poked his head inside and looked quickly around the interior.
"He's on the terrace. Park here. Walk up to the house."
Rami held out his hand.
"You don't actually believe I'd shoot the bastard?"
"Just give me your fucking gun, Alon. Otherwise you can't go up."
"Yes," Shamron began, as they sat once more on the terrace beneath the hissing gas heaters. "There was a real Yusuf al-Tafiki, but he was dead. Killed in Shatila, the night of the Falangist massacre, along with the rest of his family. One of Shamron's agents went into the house after the killing and cleaned out the family's personal papers. The al-Tafikis had no other relatives in Lebanon, only an uncle in London, a maternal uncle who had never seen his young nephew. A few days later, a boy turns up in a hospital in West Beirut. Gravely wounded, no identification. The doctors ask his name. He tells them his name is Yusuf al-Tafiki.
"How did he get the wound on his back?" Gabrielle wondered.
"It was put there by a doctor connected to the office. The boy was treated at the hospital in West Beirut, and the UN started looking for this mysterious uncle in London. It took them a week to find him. They told him what had happened to the boy. The uncle made arrangements to bring him to England."
He was a child, thought Gabrielle. 13, 14 maybe. Where had Shamron found him? How had he trained him? It was too monstrous to contemplate. Shamron snapped his powerful fingers so loudly that Rami, standing in the drive outside the guardhouse, looked up suddenly.
"Just like that, we have an agent in the enemy's camp, a boy whose life has been torn by unimaginable brutality. A boy with fire in his belly, who loathes the Israelis. A boy who will one day become a fighter and take his revenge on the people who butchered his family." Remarkable, said Gabriel.
When he was old enough, Yusuf began moving with London's radical Palestinian set. He came to the attention of a talent spotter for Tariq's organization. They vetted him. Clean, or so they thought. They put him to work in their intelligence and planning section. The office now had an agent inside one of the most dangerous terrorist organizations on Earth. He was so valuable, his material had the shortest distribution list in the history of the office. One person. Me.
Shamron stopped speaking for a moment and stretched.
A few months ago, Yusuf reported to me on a rumor that was sweeping the organization, that Tariq had a brain tumor. He was dying. The succession fight was on. His colonels were jockeying for position. And one other thing, Tariq didn't intend to go quietly. He intended to raise a little hell before he floated off to paradise. Kill an ambassador or two, bomb a few airline offices, maybe shoot down a jetliner.
So you come to me after Paris. You tell me this sad tale about how the office can't shoot straight anymore. Like a fool, I agree to your Catch Tariq operation. At the same time, you whisper into Tariq's ear that I'm back and looking for him. And the game has begun.
His organization was rigidly compartmentalized. Even with a man on the inside, I knew he was going to be hard to take down. I had to help him make a mistake. I had to give him a motive to charge, to leave himself exposed just long enough for me to plunge a sword into his heart.
So you send me after Yusuf, your own agent. You tell me he's vulnerable to an approach by a woman. It was in his file. I watch him for 2 days. He's with two different women. Were they office too?
They were Yusuf's girls. Yusuf never had much trouble finding women on his own.
I ask Jacqueline to help me, supposedly for a quick job. The job suddenly gets longer.
Shamron folded his arms, set his jaw. Clearly, he wanted to see how much of it Gabriel had figured out on his own.
All right, so Yusuf tells his people he thinks the French girl he's been seeing might be an Israeli agent. Tariq is ecstatic. Tariq has been waiting for this. He tells Yusuf to recruit the girl under false pretenses for a mission. They know Jacqueline will bite because they know she's office. Tell me, did Jacqueline know? Did Jacqueline know the truth?
Of course not. She's in love with you. She would never have agreed to deceive you.
Why didn't you just tell me the truth?
Tell me something, Gabriel. If I had come to Cornwall and asked to come out of retirement to serve as bait for Tariq, would you actually have done it? Of course not.
So you put my life on the line, and Jacqueline's?
I'm sorry about what happened in New York. It went much further than I ever anticipated.
But he was already dying. Why didn't you just let the tumor kill Tariq?
Because his organization would have carried on without him. It would have been more dangerous and unpredictable than before. And because my organization was in shambles. The office needed a coup to restore the confidence of the government and the people of Israel.
What if the government and the people found out exactly how you pulled off this great coup?
The Prime Minister knows everything.
And the people?
Don't get any ideas about running to the newspapers.
Why, because I might end up like Benjamin Stone?
Shamron said nothing. Gabriel shook his head.
You'd do it, wouldn't you? You'd kill me too if I got in your way.
No wonder why you can't sleep at night. Someone has to do these things, Gabriel. If not me, who? If our enemies think the office is weak, then our enemies will test us. They might kill a few Jews whenever they felt like it. The Syrians might come rolling out of those hills again and try to drive us into the sea. Another Hitler might get the idea that he can exterminate my people while the world stands by and does nothing.
Why such elaborate deceptions? Gabriel asked.
Shamron managed a weak smile.
Did I ever tell you about the night we kidnapped Eichmann?
I've heard the story 100 times.
Never the whole story, though.
Shamron closed his eyes and winced slightly, as if the memory were painful.
We knew the bastard rode the same bus home every night. All we had to do was grab him as he stepped off. We'd practiced it 100 times. During the drills, I was able to perform the snatch in 12 seconds. But that night, as I climbed out of the car, I tripped. Eichmann nearly got away from us because I tripped. Do you know why I tripped, Gabriel? I tripped because I had forgotten to tie my shoelaces. I got him, of course, but I learned a valuable lesson that night. Leave absolutely nothing to chance.
So it was no accident Yusuf walked past my table tonight in Tel Aviv, Gabriel asked. Your people followed me, and you sent him there so I would see him. You wanted me to know the truth.
Shamron inclined his head a fraction of an inch.
Indeed.
It was 4 o'clock in the morning by the time Gabriel returned to the flat in Jerusalem. On the table was a large office envelope. Inside were 3 smaller packets, one containing an airline ticket for the morning flight to London, another containing 3 passports of different nationalities, and a third filled with American dollars and British pounds. Gabriel placed the smaller envelopes in the larger one and carried it into the bedroom, where he packed his remaining possessions into his rucksack. The flight wasn't for another 5 hours. He thought about sleeping, knew he couldn't. He thought about driving up to Herzliya. Jacqueline. None of it had been real. Only Jacqueline. He went into the kitchen and made coffee. Then he stepped out onto the balcony and waited for dawn. Port Navis, Cornwall. Something made Peel wake up. He rolled onto his side and looked at the clock, 3:15 a.m. His mother and Derek quietly quarreling in the room next door.
Having trouble with the new play, Peel heard Derek saying. Can't seem to find my way into the first act. Hard with a child in the house. Back to London to be with his father. Time alone together. Lovers again.
Peel squeezed his eyes tightly. He refused to permit the tears to escape. He was about to cover his ears with his pillow when he heard a sound outside on the quay. A car engine. He sat up, grabbed his torch, and made it to the window just in time to see the car vanish into the trees. But then the car appeared again. Only now, Peel was staring directly into the headlights. It was an MG, and it was stopping in front of the old foreman's cottage. Peel raised his torch, aimed it at the car, and flashed the light twice. The lights of the MG winked back. Then the engine died, and the lights went dark. Peel climbed back into bed and pulled his blankets beneath his chin. Derek and his mother were still quarreling, but he didn't really care. The stranger was back in Port Navis. Peel closed his eyes and soon was asleep. This is Jason Culp. We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Kill Artist by Daniel Silva. This program was produced by David Rapkin and directed by Robert Kessler. Copyright 2000 by Daniel Silva. Production copyright Random House Inc., all rights reserved. The book The Kill Artist can be found wherever Random House books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.